Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program.
Hi there, and thanks for joining us. Well, last week's attempted coup in Turkey, a key NATO ally and critical partner in the current refugee crisis, also has a critical religious dimension. And in a few moments on Sunday night, we'll turn our attention to the man and the movement that President Erdogan of Turkey is holding responsible for the coup, Fethullah Gulen, and the movement called Hizmet. Well, the toll of thousands arrested by President Erdogan of Turkey following last week's coup grows by, seems, more thousands each day. Lawyers, judges, soldiers, teachers, journalists. They all, according to the Turkish government, are pawns of the Hizmet or Gulen movement, as it is known after its leader in exile, Fethullah Gulen. So what is the Gulen movement and what is the religious message at its core? And to what extent is it responsible for the present turmoil in Turkey? Well, joining us to discuss a movement that has many supporters in Australia and around the world is a panel of those who may be able to help. It's a pleasure to welcome Mehmet Özalp, Associate Professor at Charles Sturt University and Director of the Centre for Islamic Studies and Civilization. Mehmet, welcome to you.
Thank you.
To Dr. Peter Manning, author of Us and Them, a journalist's investigation of media, Muslims and the Middle East, and known to many as Peter Manning, former director of ABC News and Current Affairs. Peter Manning, welcome to you.
Good evening.
Good to have you back in the ABC studios.
Feel at home already.
And in our Perth studios, Dr. David Tittensaw, research fellow at Deakin University and author of a book on the Gulen movement. David Tittensaw, thanks for joining us.
Good evening.
David, perhaps I could ask you, from your information, what's the span of the arrests being made in the wake of this coup? And do the arrests in any way reflect the size of the coup itself?
Well, the arrests are quite expansive. And as you pointed out, they're getting bigger and bigger every day. And I think that really what's going on here is probably moving beyond those that were involved in the coup, and this is really more probably cleaning house in complete terms, in the sense that anyone that's potentially oppositional now is being cleared out from every sector of the state. And we've seen that, for example, with the education sector, where you had 1,500 deans were sacked, and there's, I think, been somewhere in the vicinity of 20,000 or more educationalists now which have also been sacked. So it's quite remarkable the number of people that have been removed and detained at this point.
Mehmet, have you got any understanding of the breadth of this from your perspective, being in touch with people in Turkey?
Well, I haven't been able to be in touch with people. No one's answering their phones, including my relatives. Everyone's just worried about communication. But I've been watching the media channels that Turkey has on internet and in Turkish, and it's been sweeping sackings and purging in government, but also any institution that are linked with the movement. Just there were some numbers today, actually, in Turkish media. We're talking about 35 hospitals, 15 universities, close to 1,000 schools, more than 1,000 NGOs, and I think 19 trade unions have been closed and shut down, and along with, and that's the public sector, it's not the state. And probably you're looking at another 100,000 people there. And if we, this is a major impact on Turkish society. It's a watershed moment in Turkish history. Not only the coup itself, which I think all Turks did not want, and are grateful that it did not go ahead successfully. That was the first thing. The response to that is also quite extraordinary for Turkey itself. I think it's a historic moment. It will change Turkish society in a dramatic way.
Peter Manning, let me bring you in here. Your book, A Journalist's Investigation of Media, Muslims and the Middle East, the beginning of the week when news of this first broke, it almost seemed as though the media, because it didn't know what the Gulen movement was, accepted the Turkish government's view of events right from the first few hours up to even the first 36 hours. It was almost as though this Gulen movement, we don't know about it, it sounds pretty scary. The government line was the one that tended to predominate in the news.
Yes, I think that's right, John. I was a bit horrified, to be honest, that quite a lot of journalists, including ABC journalists, whom I have obviously a lot of time for, had dropped their traditional scepticism in the wake of the, you know, terrible deaths that followed the coup, and were, you know, picking up the public relations line of the Erdogan people. Now, we were yet to find out who was behind this, and I think a degree of scepticism, or at least arm's length reporting, where, you know, she says, he says, etc., didn't exist. And I really felt that, you know, the ABC and other media were not treating the public to, you know, a proper analysis of what was going on. It wasn't as though this was an unknown government. It had a bit of a record already, which the EU had objected to, of jailing journalists and human rights abuses and so on and so on. So, you know, there was a... You would have thought that journalists would have been more sceptical of the official government line.
I was somewhat surprised listening to the insiders, or watching the insiders last Sunday morning, that even Foreign Minister Julie Bishop referred to the Islamist Gulenist movement. And it struck me at that time, the Foreign Minister is not going to say that unless she is advised. So it doesn't seem that this is just within the journalistic community that there appeared to be some confusion about this.
Well, there was this assumption that the Gulenist movement was some little sect somewhere or other that had gone slightly crazy, which was not the case at all, so far as one could see. Number one, it isn't a small Gulenist movement. It's quite large. We'll talk about that. But whether it was involved in the coup or not was a major question of contestation. And you would have thought the media would have kind of held off. And certainly, you know, Julie Bishop, I was very surprised that... presumably on the advice of DFAT and ambassadors and so on and so on, was sticking her head out as well.
David Tittensaw, how did you feel about that, David? Did you notice that on the insiders?
Absolutely. Due to the time difference, actually, a colleague of mine brought it to my attention, so I dutifully watched and was actually quite taken aback that it was really, as you've been talking about, sort of the parroting of what was the official line coming out of the government, and actually prompted me to write something to actually sort of advocate for perhaps, as what Peter was saying, a more arm's length kind of analysis, going, well, we don't have all the facts at this point. So rather than sort of actually declaring that it is or isn't a particular group, that we sort of call for a bit of, as you said, a healthy dose of skepticism, say, let's try and get to the bottom of it. And I found that the reporting across the board was actually quite sort of timid, if you like, to begin with. It was just constant articles saying, who is the Gulen movement? Why are they doing this? And what are the consequences, rather than saying, well, is it actually the Gulen movement? So I was very surprised that the foreign minister actually went with that line, which was a very uncritical sort of take on the current events.
Mehmet.
Yeah, the current position of the Turkish government and Erdogan is that not only the movement is involved in the coup, but actually Gulen himself is the mastermind.
And of course, Fethullah Gulen himself has lived in exile in the United States, self-imposed exile, for some years.
Since 1998. Actually, it was kind of exile after another coup attempt in 1998. He never returned back after that. But what is important in relation to the coup, obviously there's an allegation, and Gulen himself publicly denied the allegations and accusations. So now, as John Kerry said, there needs to be proof, because one side is saying it's Gulen and the movement. Gulen himself is saying, I haven't done it. He even said, I listened to his interviews that he gave to international media, and on they have a website. And he actually said that even if the suggestion is done to me of a coup, I would throw myself in front of it and stop it. He said, I'm 77 years old. I want to meet my Lord without having, you know, committed any oppression or transgress people's rights, which coups do inevitably. And he said, I lived through them myself many times. So it doesn't seem consistent in that. Obviously, government side is saying that he's denying it, his involvement. He is involved, definitely. So it needs to be proven. What I want to know, in the first couple of days, everyone said we don't know, or he was implicated, but it's been a week now. What I'm really wondering is, putting Gulen aside, which will go for a long time, his matter, but who was actually the leader of the in the military itself? Because you don't do a coup without a leader, right? The junta there, whoever carried this out, we still don't know. There was one major general, his name sort of was circulated, and he was severely beaten. There was photos of him. And Akın Öztürk, and the army chief actually said that he helped against the coup. So there's a misleading information. We still don't know who the military leader is. And it would make sense that if you know the person, you just ask him, did Gulen ask you this? And you could easily find out. Obviously, if he doesn't deny, of course.
So the fog of war is yet to clear. Before that happens, there are some things we can determine, though. Peter Manning, let me, given that you've done some background on this, on Islam and the media over the years, traditionally, people have seen the Turkish situation as being one that's pretty easily divisible. That is, you have the secularists in the army, supporters of Kemal Atatürk from the 1920s, to the great moderniser of Turkey. And over on the other side, you have stirring over the last 20 years in particular, an Islamist movement linked in some ways to the Muslim Brotherhood and what happened in Egypt and other places. And this simple binary was put up as the way tensions were moving, and Erdogan was linked to that Muslim Brotherhood tradition politically, and they were going to actually right the balance. The Gulen movement all of a sudden comes into people's consciousness, and the way it's initially explained is, well, look, you've got to understand that actually this is a three-part thing. You've got the secularists on one side, you've got the Muslim Brotherhood, Erdogan-type people on another side, and in the middle you have the Gulenists, who might be a civil society movement, but they're sort of soft Islam, if you like. So you have hard Islam, soft Islam, and secular, and that's the way we explain it all.
Yes, exactly. But it's not actually, as always, it's not actually as simple as that either, because there is a respectable Turkish left as well, a trade union, group who, fits within the European left tradition and emphasises workers' rights and so on. And that's got a respectable vote in the elections. There's a nationalist group. There's a Kemalist group, which is not just nationalist. By nationalist, I mean populist, Le Pen-type nationalism. And then there's been, until five-ish years ago, an Islamic AKP party majority. And that majority has split. And by the way, that Turkish majority democratic vote was the model, really, within the Middle East, the whole Middle East, for what an Islamic democracy could be. Indonesia was one of them, and Turkey was the other one. So you might recall that during the Arab Spring, the Egyptian protesters were all saying, we want to be like Turkey, you know, which partly meant the Muslim Brotherhood, but also just generally meant we can have a democracy and be an Islamic country. Now, what the tragedy of what we're seeing right now is a split between a more hardline Islamic line being run by Erdogan and a more moderate global Islamic line being more Sufi on the Sunni spectrum, more Sufi line run by Fethullah Gulen. Now that is, to me, an interesting divide within Turkish society, and one would have hoped that they could have, the Turkish Muslim society could have worked out that tension between the two sides. Now, of course, the way in which Erdogan, who has been increasingly despotic over these last 5 years, is dealing with that is by saying, no, they're not just a different point of view. They're actually trying to take over my government. Well, of course, as we know, from our intricate point of view, does take over a government mean running for office and doing it with some seriousness, or does it mean, you know, a military option? And, of course, to accuse the other side of a military takeover is probably the only way you're going to knock them out of the field. So I suppose my position is I'm very sceptical as to whether this whole movement, which has a different variant on the Islamic ideal, was really a military movement, or whether it was indeed a popular civic society alternative to the kind of hard line that Erdogan was winning.
David,
I think that's a very open, very open and interesting question. Yeah.
In just a moment, we'll get into the details of the nature of the Gulen movement, where it's come from, and its historic background. But just before we leave these contemporary events, David Titzor, how do you see what Peter and I have just been discussing about the nature of the way Turkish society has been seen over the last few years?
In terms of the polarisation?
Yeah.
Well, I think that there definitely has been a split within the I guess if you want to call it, for the lack of a better term, the Islamist camp. There was a convergence of ideas, obviously, when the Justice and Development Party came into power in 2002.
This is Erdogan's party.
Yes, Erdogan's party. And of course, you know, I've spoken to members from the movement and they said that they are now somewhat regretful of the fact that they did align themselves in the sense that they did choose to vote for the Justice and Development Party because they didn't see it becoming what it has become. So there has been a rupture, and obviously that rupture was building, I think, from 2010 and 11, where there were some tensions over the Gaza blockade issue and then over the Kurdish secret Kurdish talks, and then of course then there was the corruption scandal, and it was really, I think, the corruption scandal was kind of like the tipping point where there was a divergence between I think the Gulen movement and the Justice and Development Party.
This is around 2013, wasn't it, when the
And so there was definitely a rupture there, and it was more around issues of corruption, where it was a number of ministers resigned, and it was there was a wiretappings which implicated Erdogan and his son in a huge graft, you know, embezzlement of money. And, of course, this led to the prolonged crackdown on the movement. And so there's been a rupture in that camp for sure, because there was quite a happy convergence, I think, of values up until that sort of separating of ways, if you like, from early 2010 onwards, where there was more tensions and disagreements that started to come in. Prior to that, I think you've always had something of a polarization between, I guess, the secularist camp and the religious camp. I experienced it on many occasions when I lived in Turkey, particularly when I was doing my research on the Gulen movement. You had to be very careful about who you told what you were doing your research to, because if you mentioned it to the wrong person, you would get screamed at and they would tell you that these people are terrorists. And I heard that before even before we had the current situation. So that underlying tension has always been there. But now that you've got it, actually, you've got that rupture also within the religious camp. So now you're getting it from both sides where they're coming at that with that particular line.
How would you, as an academic, describe the Gulenist movement? It's certainly religious, but it expresses itself, I'll use my terms, more as a civil society movement than a political movement. Would that be generally a reasonable description?
Yeah, I tend to describe it as a social activist movement. So they, in my book, I've described them not so much as a civil society organization because I think they go beyond that. I often regard them as in terms of being like the fourth sector, where they're sort of social actors because they have business entities. So the schools are actually run for profit, but I call them non-profit maximization organizations. So they have a social issue, which was raising up a new generation of pious yet well-educated people that were actually able to go out into the modern world and help shape the world. And these new generation was often called the golden generation. So they had a very much a social objective in what they were doing. And whilst education is their core business in terms of, and Mehmet mentioned this, there's thousands of schools in Turkey and there's many more across the world. They're active in around 160 countries. Including Australia. Mehmet can probably correct me. I think there's around 16 schools in Australia. It was always hard to keep tabs because there were always new developments taking place. But so I describe them as a social activist movement because they do have the business side, as mentioned. They have hospitals, they had media holdings, and they had TV stations as well. So it went beyond being simply just a non-governmental organization. It was something much more complex and dynamic than that, if you like. So I will always describe them as a social activist network where their core business was education. But, of course, they did more than that. They had their charity, Kimse Yokmu. Is there anyone out there? And so they had those arms of their organisation as well. So they're really quite multifaceted.
And David, so, an excellent newspaper, Zaman Today.
Yes, you shouldn't forget that they had Zaman, which was...
High circulation.
Was the highest circulation newspaper in Turkey until it was shut down, I think, in May this year. As I said, it's perhaps more than simply calling it a civil society actor. It's a bit more complex than that, I think.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. John Cleary with you. We're discussing the Gulen movement. Are they behind the coup in Turkey and what is going on? Our guests in the studio are Mehmet Olsop, Associate Professor at Charles Sturt University and Director of the Centre for Islamic Studies and Civilization, Dr. Peter Manning, author of Us and Them, a journalist investigation of media Muslims in the Middle East and a former Director of News and Current Affairs here at the ABC, and Dr. David Tittenson, or research fellow at Deakin University and author of a book on the Gulen movement. Now, just before we take your questions in a moment or so, I've just got an announcement from ABC Gold Coast and Brisbane. The Queensland Police Service is seeking urgent public assistance to help locate a 5-year-old girl who went missing in Nielsen's Road, Narang, approximately 5 hours ago, who may be at significant risk. The girl is described as Caucasian in appearance with blonde shoulder-length hair, blue eyes and 115 centimetres tall. She was last seen wearing a dark pink T-shirt with a ladybird emblem on the front, dark blue denim shorts and no footwear. Anyone with information, if you're in the area, could you please ring 131 564 to provide any information you have? That is a 5-year-old girl gone missing in Nielsen's Road, Narang, approximately 5 hours ago, if you're in the ABC Gold Coast and Brisbane areas. 115 centimetres tall, last seen wearing a dark pink T-shirt, ladybird emblem on the front, dark blue denim shorts, no footwear. Could you please ring 131 564 if you have any information. You're on Sunday Night. If you want to give us a call, 1-300-800-222 is the number. 1-300-800-222. We're talking about the Gulen movement. Are they the mysterious force behind the coup in Turkey, or is something else going on? Mehmet Olsop, let's talk a little about the background of the Gulen movement. Fethullah Gulen is named for the leader of the movement at the moment. It's also known as Hizmet, but of course it begins many years before with Syed Nursi. Can you give us a little bit about the background to the movement, when it began and what its foundational principles were?
Yeah, while I do that, I just want to also clarify that I don't think we can link Erdogan completely in the Muslim Brotherhood camp. That in Turkey, Islamic development followed a different trajectory to Egypt, where Muslim Brotherhood comes from. Muslim Brotherhood actually started as a social, civil and educational movement, and then they had persecutions as well themselves, and some political involvement in Egypt and elsewhere. So it's a different... they are the biggest movement in Egypt, whereas in Turkey, the political movement, which Islamism, meaning political Islam, and social movement have followed separate paths. Erdogan belongs to that purely political Islamism path with Erbakan, and Erbakan came in early 70s. Erdogan is his student, actually, and the parties that they established were closed many times. But in the end, in 2001, they established this current party, and Erdogan is very famous to say that they have removed the Islamism shirt from themselves. So that's how they got the support, quite a coalition of support. They said, we're not going to Islamicize society. Whereas the Gulen movement goes longer with the Syed Nursi, who started 1925 with the establishment of the modern secular state. And his activism was on faith-based, and clearly, for instance, Syed Nursi said, no violence and no politics. It's very strong in Syed Nursi's activism. And in spite of that, he was arrested many times, Syed Nursi himself, and he died in 1960. There was a coup in Turkey in 1960. 3 months after he died, they took away his even body. We don't know where he's buried, Syed Nursi. So Fethullah Gulen's movement has that foundation, but he built even more than what Syed Nursi has done, made it a social, an educational and social movement based on faith. Again, that non-violence and non-politics was a very strong element of that. But obviously Erdogan and others in Turkey have always accused the movement and Gulen for being political or infiltrating the state. There was actually, after the last, the coup previous to that, there was a massive court case that Gulen had to go through from 1998 to 2008 with exactly the same charge, and he was acquitted. And at that time, the judiciary was very much secular-dominated. And Erdogan himself narrowly escaped his party being closed in 2008. So it's been really a different trajectory there rather than elsewhere in the world, and Turkey is really a unique case.
David Tittensor, just following up on this history with Syed Nursi, somebody mentioned to me during the week that one of the things that characterised what Nursi was doing was saying, look, we have to work with the modern world in Islam. So the strong educational emphasis came with an emphasis both on science and on coming to terms with modernity in as a society, that we had to take the world as it was seriously. So in political or cultural terms, that means reaching out to the EU. It's the active support of the EU. It's the support of interfaith discussions, those sorts of things which have characterised Nursi and then Gulen as he's followed on.
And involvement in education, overwhelmingly.
Yeah, I mean, Syed Nursi's principal idea, he actually wanted to set up a university which taught, I think, a variety of different languages, including Kurdish, I think. And so he always was very much focused on education. And as Mehmet rightly pointed out, Gulen has basically actualized his teachings, his idea of bringing education and religious spirituality together. And so the whole idea behind the schools, which are actually secular, is and they have the idea of temsil, which is to represent. And so the idea is not to actually teach religious education, but you sort of represent that the idea of what a pious religious individual should, how they should act, and this is reflected in the people in the schools. And so the idea was to teach science, teach modern subjects, and have people who are spiritually inclined but able to engage in the modern world. And this is the principal idea, which has been carried forward from Nursi into the schools. As I said, he wanted to set up a university. That was his idea, which was shut down before the Republic, indeed. And so that's what Gulen has been doing, is taking that idea of modern education with spirituality and actualizing that through the schools.
Why then, and perhaps I'm asking the bleeding obvious, why then is it so easy for Erdogan to say these people are mounting a coup and to get such a huge turnout of popular support? What triggers that if people know that the Gulen movement at the grassroots level has been principally involved in education and that sort of movement, yet Erdogan can say they are the coup plotters and get huge support on the streets?
Well, as I touched on before, is that when I was doing my research, the secularist faction of society was very anti-Gulen movement. So if you were to mention it to the wrong person, you could get a very vehement reaction. For example, one university I was at, they wanted me to do some English language teaching whilst I was there on my visiting scholarship. And they put me in touch with the person that was going to do the paperwork. And I assumed, quite wrongly or naively, that this person was also from the movement. And when he very kindly asked me, what is your research about, I explained that I was looking at the schools and what the movement was doing. The next day when I came to do the paperwork, I was told that I could not be at the university because I would tarnish the image of the university. And so there was a very strong anti-Gulen feeling within the secularist camp. And a lot of the universities, particularly the older private universities, were very much bastions of secularism. So I was ejected. I was told I couldn't be here. And even though I'm not a member of the movement, by association I was tainted. So there was always that very strong negative reaction to the Gulen movement prior to the current situation. And so there's that faction which was against them. And there was always the accusation that they're infiltrating the state and that the way they were doing this is that they were educating people through their schools, and the schools were very successful. And so these people would then go into the judiciary, the police force, and so on. And the accusation was that they're taking over the state, surreptitiously by stocking people in these the apparatuses of the state. So this was the secularist line, and you'd often find this reported in the media. And there were also books written by journalists which talked about this, saying that he's people in these institutions. So that's always been a narrative or one of the theories about the Gulen movement from the secular side. So it's been very easy now for Erdogan to pick up on that particular trope now that he's against the movement and apply it. And so what you've now got is you've got that narrative coming from both sides of the divide. So you've got that rupture with the religionist camp. So, and I've even seen people from the movement saying now 85% of people don't like us in the country. So it's actually been a very convenient and very powerful narrative, which has been there, but now is actually being picked up by both sides of the political divide.
Peter Manning.
John, I think another explanation actually is that it's the Gulen movement in Turkey is a very impressive presence. And I went on a tour through Affinity Foundation as a private citizen about 2007. And went to various places, saw what the Gulen movement was doing in hospitals, saw what they were doing in the media. As I said, Zaman, it was the highest circulation paper, it was funded by the Gulen movement, in education, in lifting the poor into education. The analogue, I suppose, from an Australian point of view, and I've got a Catholic background, would be the Catholic Church, in a sense. Now, I know it's a civic society movement, but, think of...
It has religious foundations.
Yes. St Vincent's Hospital in Sydney, Catholic school, Waverley College out at Bondi Beach, so on, so on, so on, so on. I mean, when I left Waverley College in, thousands of years ago, I was told that I should go into the law. Why? Because there weren't enough Catholics as judges. And we should get in there. Now, I can understand how a sceptical person in Turkey or one in Australia in 1950 or 55 might have thought, oh, well, the Catholic Church is attempting to take over Australia.
Oh, they did. They were. From my little Protestant corner, they were.
No, but, you know, really. And in a sense, they were. You know, they were trying to get into, I mean, certainly they had the police lined up, you know. So it's a delicate question of how power that's being gained is accepted as a part of the democracy that you live in, and you know, you balance
it's the
it off
maturation
with checks and,
process.
Checks and balances, yeah. Or you bring out the army and you crush, you know, and you take in 60,000 people. Which leads me to just say one thing: I do want to say in this discussion is the thing that makes me most sceptical about whether this was a Gulenist coup is that 60,000 people who are allegedly Gulen people in 1 week have been arrested. Now, that to me says this has been planned for a very long time by the government, and it's put into what, I mean, we're having trouble knowing whether the seat of Moreton in Queensland has been elected, and that's taken us about, 5 weeks or something like that to figure out, and it's still not decided, you know, the news today. Still one vote, I think. So, you know, I mean, here's a government that in days was arresting 20,000, 40,000, 60,000 people. That's not a spontaneous coup. That is real planning goes into that.
An important point is, surely if you have schools and certain institutions, they will have graduates and they will going to go into society, and some of them will end up in bureaucracy. And they could do wrong things.
Exactly.
And actually, in 2013, when the corruption case against the government erupted in the media, Erdogan did the same. The next day, he blamed the movement. And the movement's response was, well, we don't know who they are, but if they've done something wrong against the line of reporting and things like that, they should be punished. So that's been the clear position of the movement.
Yes, and David, no one's suggesting that there may not be some Gulen sympathisers within the coup group.
Well, this is a very, as the point, that's a very difficult thing. When you've got hundreds, if not thousands of schools within the system, naturally there are going to be people that come through the schools. And I can say from my own research, when I interviewed graduates from those schools, there were some people that, yes, said that they did appreciate the teachings of Gulen over time and did say that they were then part of the movement. But there were others that say, no, I appreciate what the teachers have done, but that particular lifestyle, that particular way of looking at things isn't for me. But they still appreciate it. I remember particularly a student from Afghanistan who said, I love these people. I have all the time in the world for these people, but I wasn't interested in the movement side of things, but I love what they're doing. And I think there's a lot of people probably that have gone through the schools who appreciate what they do, the quality education that they provide, but wouldn't see themselves as a member of the movement. And this is a really important point in the sense that when you have a movement which is as expansive as the Gulen movement, there is no formal membership form that you fill out. The nature of how people come into the movement is actually very organic, in the sense that the narratives that I've heard is some people joined it during the school because they met people and they went to what were called sobets, which are conversations, or chai sobetleri, or tea conversations, and they became familiar with the writings of Said Nursi and Gulen, and over time they joined. And it's a very organic process, whereas you've got other people that it happened in university or later. There's no particular entry point. How it happens is different for each person. Some people do, some people don't. So, but there are still some people who are sympathetic. So this idea of calling people Gulenists, it's actually quite complicated in the sense that, well, it's someone might be appreciative of the movement but have actual no formal activities within the movement, but they may have just gone to the school and graduated from it. So it's actually quite a vexing issue in terms of when you just label a whole bunch of people as Gulenists, because there are tons of graduates that have come out of these schools who would say, yes, I like the schools, I support what they do, but I'm not a member of the movement. And that's a really important point that needs to be taken into consideration. So it's entirely possible that within the military, there are people that graduated from these schools and are sympathetic towards the movement, but aren't necessarily members of the movement. And I think another really important point that hasn't been raised, which I think we should talk about, is the fact that historically, the military has actually been extremely hostile to the Gulen movement. And there were systematic programs to actually weed people who were religious out in the late 80s and early 90s who were seen as being religious and pious.
It's the so military preserving the secular tradition.
Absolutely. And so you've got this dynamic which has played out, which means that you actually had this uphill battle, if you want to talk about infiltration of the bureaucracy, such as the police force, the judiciary and the military. In terms of the military, there was actually active pushback against this kind of thing happening. So that's another consideration that needs to be taken into place in relation to the coup dynamic, in terms of labelling all of the people as Gulenists. Well, actually, there was active pushback for years, for decades, of actual people who were religious and from the movement actually obtaining positions within the military. So it's a very, as I said, there's the fog of war, I think, is quite an apt description.
It's time to take a few calls on Sunday night. Let's say hi to John in Burley Heads. Hello, John. Welcome. What would you like to say? John's not coming on there. John, can you hear us?
Yes.
Good. What would you like to say?
Great discussion.
Thank you.
The level of erudition and the way the discussion is flowing so interesting. I find it refreshing just to be able to hear some movements within that area of the world which is so fraught and so basic on some levels, been working subtly through the history of the education, the movement. It's quite refreshing to see how it's working over there on a more political level rather than just blowing things up, you know. So it's a subtle area of discussion and education in that part of the world, I think, too, of where Islam's going and politically, socially.
Indeed. Did you have any specific questions you wanted to ask our panel?
Probably just seeing how that moves with political Islam and perhaps more violent sides of political persuasion, how it's working intellectually and where the power lies ultimately over there and what's playing out over there generally.
Would you care
to give a picture of the broader context that this is happening in?
Yeah, this goes to some of the questions, Peter Manning, you were alluding to, that there are some subtleties here that we need to be appreciative of.
Yes, well, I mean, the truth is that you've got 1 billion Muslims in the world. The vast majority want to have, you know, good lives with their family, you know, and their extended family, and suck up education as much as they possibly can to get ahead and, you know, become, you know, engineers particularly.
Could part of the current context also be that Syed Nursi and his origins is Kurdish? Does that play into this sort of nationalist, Turkish nationalism strand at all into this discussion?
Well, one of the things I admire about the Gulen people is that in their schools you can be Christian, you can be Hindu, you can be, you know, this kind of Muslim, that kind of Muslim, et cetera, et cetera. But what they're committed to is high standards of education and taking scientific discoveries on board and incorporating them into your worldview. Now, that's what we do, you know. So that's fantastic, really.
Mehmet, briefly.
I concur with the listener. Turkey has been ignored in Islamic development for ages. Books been written by famous scholars, they completely miss out Turkey. I think it's time that we really looked at the kind of history that Turkey has experienced.
Let's go to Kevin in Bunbury. Hello, Kevin. What would you like to say? Kevin, you there?
Hello.
David in Brisbane. Yeah. Sorry, pressed the wrong button. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good.
Gentlemen, quick question. The changes in I guess, the law since Ataturk set up the secular society. It sort of, to me, would indicate that Turkey is heading towards a dictatorship. And I'm wondering, with the Kurdish and the Syrian refugees also in living within Turkey, are they actually having an effect on the direction that Turkey's heading in?
David, do you want to say something on this first?
I wouldn't think so. In the sense that recently there were reports that with the Syrian refugees that there was going to be offer of potential citizenship. And there was actually, I think from some segments of the community, there was actually a backlash against this, if I recall correctly. So I think that was a contentious issue in terms of the Syrian refugees being welcomed in. And I think that speaks more to the fact that you've got IS attacks and there's concern about security and so on. But above and beyond that, I don't think it would be having an impact in that way.
The test on the nature of Turkish society or politics or state will be the new constitution. I'm guessing that Erdogan will develop a new constitution and bring in executive presidency that he's been chasing for a number of years, talking about it publicly. That's almost certain to come along. And it would be really good to interesting to watch what kind of constitution will be produced. I think that will be the key test.
Mm. Definitely. Mm-hmm. That sounds very interesting. I'd be keen to see what direction that's heading in. Is there any time frame, do you think, before we'll see this constitution put up?
Don't know, but Erdogan tends to move very quickly.
So you think that he's probably already got it printed and waiting in the wings?
I don't know.
Certainly the powers of emergency will probably be extended, won't they, relatively quickly in the next...
Well, the new constitution will be designed, Mehmet, won't it, to give Erdogan far more power.
Well, he wants an executive presidency, and we don't know what that means. He mentioned Turkish style. Which means not European or Western style.
Ads against Russian style.
People I was going to say that might be Putin.
Yeah.
Putin
but,
style.
I think we have to just wait and see, but everyone's worried in Turkey. And some are jubilant about that, you know. I think one of the most important thing about Turkey at the moment is society is extremely polarized. Yes, 50% population do support Erdogan. They find him a great leader. But other 50% passionately despise him. And these could be people in same household.
Yeah, without opening up another whole discussion, but in a funny way, it is a mirror of Trump in the United States and the Brexit thing. It's the people who feel left out saying, we want to be part of this. It's that populism.
Yes.
It's a resurgent populism. Yes.
Let's hope it doesn't go into a civil physical hot action.
Yeah, David, thanks for your call. Now to Kevin in Bunbury. Hello, Kevin. How are you?
Hi. You're pretty tight for time, so I'll make it pretty swift.
Yep.
Freedom of religious belief is paramount to world peace. How is it that world confrontation is about countries with Islamic or Muslim majorities?
All right, we'll give you about a minute on that, because that's all we've got. Mehmet, very briefly.
Well, the Muslim world has gone through a colonization experience. 95% of the Muslim world lost their freedom, and then they had to gain their freedom. The entire classic societies collapsed. And then you had the Cold War, where Muslim Middle East was caught in between. They're really going through a new phase at the moment, and I think we're going to see until democracies mature events like this in the Muslim world.
Yeah, and maturation is a hard thing. Russia's finding it hard. Poland's finding it hard. I mean, this is not something that's simply a function of Islam. We've run out of time. It's been great to have you with us. It always goes too fast. It's been very good to have Dr. David Tittensaw, Research Fellow at Deakin University and author of a book on the Gulen Movement. You could look him up. Peter Manning, author of Us and Them, A Journalist's Investigation of Media Muslims and the Middle East, book currently in print, published by
Random House.
And Mehmet Oza. Thank you so much for joining us